Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the record fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my special guest co-host and guest for tonight's show. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular the early NFL history, especially the 1925 Pottstown Maroons. He has one of the most advanced collections of football cards and memorabilia from 1888 to 1988 in the country. And at this time, I'd like to welcome our special guest, co-host and host and guest, Mr. Jeff Payne, for the show this evening. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob. Good to hear from you. Happy to be here.
I thank you for filling in some big shoes of Mr. Squires, our regular co-host, who was on vacation this week. But in any event, I'm glad you could fill in. And we got plenty of stuff to talk about, and we're going to cut to the chase immediately. And we're going to get a few updates on your incredible collection cards and memorabilia spanning a 100-year period from 1888 to 1988. I was very fortunate several years ago when we could really travel very freely to attend one of your weekends down there, hitting a show in Pennsylvania and then watching a game on Sunday and looking at your collection. So we got a few areas to go over, a few areas to talk about. I'm going to lead off by talking and asking you about what's new in your collection. And I understand you got something you've been waiting for a long time and an incredible pickup, rare pickup for your collection. I'll hand it off to you now.
Yes, thanks, Bob. Yeah, I'm very excited. I did pick up a Red Grange card that I've been trying to get for a long time. But what's interesting, before I talk about that card, when I got this card the other day, just got it this past week, I was pulling out some of my Grange cards and just looking at stuff and just, you know, enjoying this new edition. And it struck me how many football cards Red Grange has. You know, we always talk about pre-war. You know, hardly any of the Hall of Famers have a card, maybe one if they're lucky. And I'm not even counting, you know, matchbooks, Wheaties, you know, box cuts, just straight, real football cards. Red Grange, I counted them up. So I counted, and I could be off a few. He has 47 cards from his playing days, which not only is, of course, by far the most number of cards for any pre-war player, but I would actually challenge anybody to come up with another player in the vintage era, and I'm calling that 1888 to 1988, that has as many football cards as Red Grange has. It never struck me before what a you know, marketing juggernaut he was and his manager was. And in an era when there's no football cards, hardly, he has 47.
Right.
Is incredible. Now, you could argue some of those are movie star cards. So, you know, are those legitimately football cards? Well, just take those out then, right? If you take those out, he still has 19 cards from his playing days. And I was trying to think of any NFL player through the entire, you know, vintage period that would have 19 cards. And I'm coming up pretty blank. I'm thinking maybe Unitas might be up there. It's got to be somebody that played a long time, and it's got to be somebody that was a star enough that Topps or, you know, Philly or Fleer or somebody would have, you know, made sure they had cards nearly every year. And, boy, I'm coming up empty, which is really surprising to me, right? Isn't that strange?
Off the top of my head, I always use 25 as the cut. First, I thought Grange had, not counting the movie cards, I thought he had around 25 cards. But I will say you're much more accurate than me looking at 19 cards on that, number one. Number two, again, remembering what, like you're saying, and I go to the insert era of the 60s where a star player may have had one or two more additional posters or actual, you know, card, you know, the glossy card or whatever, or pinup poster, so on and so forth, which is technically not a card. So you're right.
Yeah.
I always said it was like 20 to 25 cards would be the most any star player from that time would actually have, and never mind all the minor stars who, again, if they had a card in the NFL, the regular top series, and if their team produced a police set, they would have two cards for the year, and that's it. Remember, and you're well aware, Fleer Team in Action, 76 to 88, it was all generic cards, and the players were not named on them, but obviously you could tell if there was a Peyton or Bart Starr or whatever. But in any event, yeah, you're right. You know, Red Grange was a popular player. He was a very marketable player, and he did get his due back then as far as the amount of cards in print for him. And again, adding the movies, the movie cards, almost 50 cards. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That really is.
Yeah, and that's just
and
from
that's
his playing
me.
Days. I kind of cut it off when he retired. I mean, there's a bunch of cards after that, right? I'm not counting his Topps All American card. You know, Mayfair Candy came out later. I'm not counting Wheaties cuts, ink blotters, you know, RPPCs. I mean, boy, you start adding all that into it, and his number's going to skyrocket.
Right. So it's very interesting to think about that in comparison to the overproduction of a player's card today, where you could see in just 1 year, one player has 50 cards from all the different sets, subsets, inserts, so on and so forth. That's 50 from one season. This is one of the greatest players who ever walked the gridiron. He doesn't even have 50 cards. And
right.
You know, that's something you got to put in perspective, but it's really amazing. Really amazing to think about. And again, I always thought 25, 20 to 25. That was always my cutoff for any player of, you're right, the vintage era. Vintage era until we got into the explosion in 1989 and to this day, where there's just so many sets and so many cards of one player, just difficult to really to try to collect, to say the least. That's good. That's a great observation on your part, looking at that view again. And I will assume with your big pickup, you have all those. You have all 47, correct?
Well, I'm missing one, and it's a movie card, so it's not one of his, you know, football ones, but I am missing one.
Okay.
So I'll keep looking for that, but I'm close. Close. Yeah.
Okay.
So back to the pickup. So one of the ones I've been chasing now for over a decade is his 1929-30 Rogers Pete card. So you know, I don't know how many out in the audience know these cards, but in the late 20s, 1929, a men's clothier chain called Rogers Pete had a premium redemption promo that they ran. They created a multi-sport set of 48 cards that they distributed to children or kids who visited the store, obviously a way to get their parents to come in and buy some stuff. And the way it worked was if you came into the store, you would get a group of four cards. Kids would get a group of four cards, and they also were given albums that they could, you know, paste these cards into. And if you could complete the album with 48 cards, all 48 of the cards, there were prizes that you could get from Rogers Pete. And so, you know, this set has a Red Grange in it. It actually has four football players in it, you know, including Ken Strong, another Hall of Famer, Chris Cagle, who was a multi-time All-American at Army, and a multi All-American Ed Whitmer from Princeton, were the four football. There's a bunch of baseball and other sports in there, but they're very hard cards to find. You know, I'm fortunate I got all four of them now, but if you look at the population reports, and of course these are graded, there's raw ones out there we don't know about, but almost every card in this set has a population, graded population well under 10, right? A lot of them are 5, or the Grange is 3. There's only 3 of them that at least I know of that exist. And so it's not the kind of card you just, you know, you find laying out there on eBay. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And
so,
we talked about this before, and then again, your expert opinion on it. Why are there so few of these found? And again, I always estimated if there's 12 of each, that's a lot. But what's your viewpoint of the why they're so difficult to find and literally impossible to find in the market?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. So first, I think you got to look at the year these came out. And I don't know when in 1929 the promotion started. We do know it went into 1930. But, you know, that's right when the market crashed and we entered the Great Depression. I'm guessing that not a lot of people were going to Rogers Pete and buying new clothes there for a while, like maybe for a decade. And so I'm kind of wondering how many of these cards actually got out into circulation, how many people were actually coming into these stores once the market crashed. So I think that's one. Two is, you know, some of these are so rare. There are certainly ones that are there's, you know, significantly more out there. Significant means 10, you know, than others. It makes you wonder if for some of the stars, they held back those cards, you know, to kind of control how many albums could be, you know, completed. You know, they obviously didn't want to give a prize out to everybody. And so it's a chance that some of these were short printed. And I would think Grange would definitely be a candidate for a short print, right? You'd want the kids coming back looking for the Grange card. I think that might be part of it too. And then obviously when the albums were redeemed. They were probably destroyed. You wouldn't want somebody to be able to redeem them multiple times, so they probably destroyed any that got turned in. And then you got the paper drives, right, of the war later on after, you know, a decade later. I think all those contribute to, you know, a lot of the reasons why the sets from that era are so, you know, so scarce and the cards are so scarce. And that's my thought on it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a two-folded issue. I do agree with you 100% on the Depression hitting. Sales for Roger P. may have collapsed completely. And the second big thing, I believe, is the combination of how many albums were turned in and then ultimately destroyed with the paper drives that occurred roughly 12 to 13 years later for the war effort. So, again, I've always maintained the amounts of pre-World War II paper, programs, magazines, books, cards, any type of paper was going into the war effort. So how much of the real history in paper of the game of football, between football cards and actual printed word memorabilia, were destroyed during that time frame? So that's why I've always said anything. I truly believe anything 1940 and back in professional football or college football is exceptionally rare. One can argue there's really not a great demand for certain colleges programs. I'll give them that. But at the same time, I really don't think there's a lot in circulation, even in private collection hands. The Rogers Pete, I've always said, something I've always maintained, I believe a max of 12 cards of each football player actually exists. The three graded or four graded of what we have, Grange being the rarest. And there's probably, I can venture to say, there's probably 6 to 12 private football card collections that we will never hear about, we will never see come to the market, and those cards could be nestled in one of those or all of those collections at the same time. And I think that's, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head with regards to your theory on it. And that makes it even more of an exceptional pickup and more of an exceptionally rare card to find. And again, I don't really think there's any warehouse finds of those coming up in the near future. You know what I mean? You're not going to all of a sudden see unearthed two shipping boxes full of Roger Pete albums filled that were sitting somewhere in an American Pickers type barn somewhere that are going unkept, if you know what I mean. So I do agree with your theories, and I think that's probably what's made them so rare in our market today. So that's an incredible pickup, Jeff. I got to congratulate you on it. I mean, it's just amazing, truly amazing. And again, if you get one movie card, you're pretty well set.
Long time coming. I got the other three about a decade ago, and I didn't even know. I knew they were rare. I'd never heard of them, but I was, you know, a decade or so ago, I was just getting back into the hobby, and I didn't really yet appreciate how rare they were. But our friends at MSB, you know, Spano and Becker, John Spano and Andy Becker, actually had all four of them. And they had them in their online store, and I missed on the Grange. Yep. It was gone by the time I got there and noticed it. But really, John Spano nudged me, and he's like, "You should pick up these other three. These do not show up very often." And I'm like,
"Exactly.
How often?" And he's like, "You might never see them again often." So I was like, "Okay." So I'm glad I picked those up. But then, of course, now I'm a completist. I like to complete sets. Now I'm missing one, and it's the Grange. So I counted up. I missed it 5 times, which is a lot for it to even appear. It was two different examples. There's three that are known, two different ones. You know, through the last decade, I've had at least one shot at and just couldn't make it happen. Sometimes it was a private thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was an auction. So I'm just happy that after all those tries, I finally got it. excited about that.
The first time I heard about Roger's Pete was at a show in the early 1990s. I was going through some notes over the weekend, and I was at a local show in Hartford, Connecticut at the time, and a dealer was explaining to me, because he knew I collected only football, he was explaining to me of the four known football cards. He had a couple of the baseball ones, and I had no interest in buying the baseball ones, but he said, if you ever see the football ones, he said, by all means, buy them, because he said to me, according to my notes, he believed there was less than 50 of each card in existence at that time, and it was 1992. We're going back 30 years on this, so he was right, and to say the least. It was a rare cards, and again, if hindsight is, you know, everything, I would have been a multi-millionaire by now. Buying the cards I saw from years ago, I should have pounced on those baseball ones, and I could have sold them easily down the road years later at a strong profit. So it's interesting. It to me, it's what makes the hobby what it is. I mean, chasing a very rare card such as that. We've talked numerous times about the rarities of 1894, of the Mayo sets of 1894. We talked about the high number rarities of the Chickle set. We talked about the rarities of the Shotwells. I mean, there's just not a lot of them in the market, one way or the other. And, again, Mayos. How many Mayos are in existence? Maybe 40 or 50 of each card. How many of the Dunlops?
Yeah.
Maybe 10 or 15? I really don't know. You know, we'll never know.
Yeah.
So it makes for a great collecting journey and great satisfaction. Again, once an advanced collector like you picks up something like that, that's a great sense of completion, and just adds, in my mind, to the both the completeness and the intensity of your collection, especially with the pre-World War II items. It's just truly incredible, to say the least. So I do congratulate you on your pickup. I know you slept better that night once you had it in hand, and onward to the next pickup. So after that, I'm just curious. This is off script a little. What's your next white whale, if anything?
Oh boy, what's the next white whale? Boy, that's a toughie. That is a toughie. What would it be? I mean, I've been chasing that card for so long. Obviously, we've talked about the Pottsville Maroons postcards, which I chased so long, got those completed. There's some early Thorpe things, postcards and other things, that are definitely on my want list that I don't have because I'm a big Thorpe fan as well. I'd like to get a few missing pieces there from Thorpe. RPPCs and things like that. I mean, unfortunately, he doesn't have any football cards from his playing days, which is a bummer.
Right.
But, you know, there are baseball and track items and other things. But I'm thinking like early football, you know, Carlisle, early days of this Carlisle. You know, career. There's a few postcards and other things out there that, you know, I've seen once or twice in a decade, and I'm like, oh man, I need those. Those are definitely on my list for sure. Completing. I mean, you know, the oddball sets. You know, even up through the '60s and '70s, some of those oddball sets, those regional sets, those food sets. They are just impossible to finish. And I've got one list in some of those sets that I'm still working on. And, you know, it's amazing how hard it is to find some of that material as well, you know?
I agree. I chased it for a long time. And, I always used to tell people back in the 80s, I had dealers who – would have the proverbial cheese box behind the behind their table, and when no one was looking, they would pull it out and say, "This is all football. Give me $5 for the box and get out of here," type of thing. Mm. So it's a whole different game today. It's very interesting. I agree with you 110%. Oddball football, insert, old insert, regional sets, team issues, so on and so forth, continues to be somewhat overlooked, but it's overlooked because a lot of individual collectors don't know anything about them, number one. And number two, they're so difficult to find. And it's amazing. I always use the example, which I don't know if you have any or not, the 1959 San Giorgio flipbooks, which are not technically cards, but they're just like a little, for lack of a better term, miniature comic book, which I have never, to this day, have seen one in person at a show. I mean, I've seen them online. Mm. I've read about them in the Beckett books over the years and so on. But I've never, that is one piece I have still yet to see in person, just to see what it looked like. Mm. So that's something that is so, to me, rare, beyond rare. And I know a few collectors who actually have the complete set of them. So it's a, you know, that's another brutal set or type card for a lot of collectors trying to find at least one of them. It's just another amazing piece to find if you could ever, you know, actually come around and find one of those. So and there are also some of the early police sets that were issued, including the, I think it's either 79 or 80 for the Tampa Bay Bucks, from, I think it's called Tentadine, was the issuer. I have never seen a complete set of that. I've seen pieces, I've seen cards of it. I know I have a handful of cards from the set, but I've never seen a complete set of it. It's just truly amazing, and that's rare of rare. So it's, you know, half the fun of the chase is always finding something new. Advanced collectors like you and I know what we're looking for, and then it becomes very frustrating to try to end up, you know, after, you know, 20 years of looking for something, you still don't see it. It truly is beyond rare type of thing. And I would think with all the nationals I've attended, I still haven't seen one of those flip books there. And if they were there, I did not see it. I missed it. So it's... Yeah. It's interesting to say the least. The second area I'd like to talk about tonight deals with some travel crates, and I'm going to hand that off to you with your background on that.
Yeah, so another thing, we mentioned Thorpe earlier. I chase anything Thorpe-related. I read about Thorpe, just like Grange when I was a kid. And just loved his story and the, you know, heartbreak of the Olympics and having his medals taken and what a great athlete he was. So when I got into pre-war, I started going after anything Thorpe-related. And, of course, you know, he played in the NFL for quite a while, but he was pretty old by then. But one thing that always fascinated me was this early NFL team called the Orang Indians, you know, that played in 22 and 23. A fascinating story, considered the first team to provide halftime entertainment is one way to describe it. You know, how it all happened was Jim Thorpe, you know, he knew a lot of people. He spent a lot of time, obviously, in Ohio, where he played with the Bulldogs and others. And he befriended this owner of a dog breeding company called, you know, Lingo Kennels. Orang Kennels, actually, Walter Lingo. And he used to hunt with Walter and his brother and such, and he had a lot of land. Well, Walter sold these Orang Airedale Terriers. That was his business. He was a dog breeder. And the thing was is that he got more for a dog than an NFL franchise cost at that time. Like the NFL was asking $100 for a franchise, and he was selling his dogs for $150. And he and Thorpe got to talking, and he was like, I wonder if there's a way I could use football and the NFL to market my dogs, my dog business. And he convinced Thorpe to start a team in little tiny LaRue, Ohio. Definitely trivia question. Smallest town to ever have an NFL franchise. I think that's pretty clear because apparently it was very small. He convinced Thorpe, and he gave Thorpe a job. Basically, he said, look, if you'll start a football team, I'll buy a franchise. You know, you can we'll do an all-Indian team. So get your buddies from Carlisle, Haskell, anywhere you can, you can get, good players. And let's have an NFL team. It's going to be mostly travel because we don't have a stadium. My only condition is a couple things. One is that as part of the deal, you help run the kennel and train the dogs, and Thorpe was all into that kind of stuff. He was way into that. And that the rest of the players help as well. And that as part of the football game, at halftime, you do some performances, have some Indian acts and performances, get the dogs out there, maybe simulate a hunt. They wrestled a bear once in a while. They did all sorts of stuff as a way, obviously, to attract people to the games. But also, of course, Walter Lingo was trying to sell dogs. And apparently that worked really, really well initially. And it was cheap marketing for his kennel. There's a great book out there about the Orang Indians, Chris Willis, who I know you've had on the show. Yep. He's wrote great football books. He wrote an awesome book on the Orang Indians, if anybody's interested in it. But back to the original question about the crates. So years ago, there was a traveling Native American display that apparently went around the country, talked about Native American heritage. And they, I don't know how they acquired them or if it was affiliated with the Orang Indians, but they secured a set of travel crates and travel bags. These were wooden crates that you filled up with your stuff, and they were put on trains or however else travel was being done that the Orang Indians used to pack up their stuff and take it with them when they went on the road. There were also bags and blankets and whatnot. And what is really cool is all of these crates and all these bags and blankets are all stamped with the Orang Indian logo. They're stamped with the dog logo from Walter Lingo's breeding company. And they have the players' names on them, whose bag it was. So when they were getting their stuff out of, however they got their equipment to where they were going, they knew whose was whose. They also said Jim Thorpe coach or Coach Jim Thorpe on them as well. And these are part of this display, apparently, and apparently they sat in a warehouse for a long time until someone, and I don't even know the origin, discovered them and brought them to market. And a couple of them sold, 3, 4, 5 years ago. A couple bags sold at auction, a couple of crates sold at auction. I saw them. I went after them. I didn't get them. I just wanted one, right? I was like, oh, man, that is so cool. I would love to have an Orang Indian, travel crate. And so missed it and been snooping around trying to see if I could find one to pick up. And I just happened to mention to another collector you and I know pretty well, and that I was looking for one of these. I'd love to add it as a display piece, to my collection. And he said, oh, I know who has those. If you want, here's the person you should contact. Maybe they'll sell you one. I was like, okay, good lead. Thank you. So I called this individual, who's someone else we know pretty well. And I got a big surprise because he said, you know what? I actually would like to sell all of these, all the bags, all the crates. I was like, you found your buyer. So I was able to pick up from him 5 Orang Indian travel crates, so 5 of them, different sizes. and 7 bags and blankets, all stamped with, you know, Joe Guyon, for instance, you know, Hall of Famer. He was a player that played with Thorpe at Carlisle and is in the Hall of Fame. I mean, some of it is his stuff. Some of the other Indians that, you know, go back with Thorpe to his playing days at Carlisle. Just a great find. Boy, I'll tell you, I was over the roof when we were able to strike a deal and get those.
Well, those,
because I just wanted one. Really.
Those incredible display pieces and the history of them is just incredible. I mean, you know, you appreciate history of the game. Can you imagine Thorpe touching, you know, those crates, the bags, the blankets, so on and so forth? It's just amazing to think about. And I think that's one thing that's overlooked to some collectors. Again, when you're thinking about the history of the early game and how much of that stuff actually survived, I mean, how many crates are out there? You know, it's another, you know, another question we could throw out there. You know, how many exist? How many got repainted, reused, so on and so forth? I mean, it's an amazing story to get that many all at once and to collect them. And, you know, again, you're the keeper, one of the keepers of the early game of the history of the NFL. And those are definitely Hall of Fame pieces, to say the least. So, and I'm curious, do you know if the Hall of Fame has any of that stuff? I don't think they do.
I do not know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was at the hall in August, and I did meet with the archivist there. And I did reach back out because I wanted to set some time up to go back when I can, you know, dig through some of the archives and see what they actually do have, because they have a lot of stuff. Yeah. That was made pretty clear. I got a tour of their archive, like at a high level, and back in the back wing, and the amount of stuff they have is incredible. That's the good news. The bad news is they can only show just a small fraction of it at any given time. So a lot of it's just sitting, you know, it's just sitting on shelves or in rolling cases that they have. And you know, it's not getting any attention, which is kind of a bummer, but at least it's being saved, right? It's not being destroyed, which is a good thing. But I don't know if they have anything from Oorang. I'd love to find out.
Yeah. And to me, one of my big criticisms of the Hall of Fame is the National Football League is a multi-billion-dollar business. How much would it take for the NFL to give the Pro Football Hall of Fame an additional X amount of dollars? Listen, you got to expand. If you can't do it in Canton, can you do it in an adjacent town? Build a 5,000-7,000 square foot facility, up to date, and get the stuff out to show and show the history of the game. And I'm just in a way, I'm just shocked that the four Hall of Fames. And I've been to all but the hockey one, you know, Cooperstown, Springfield with the Basketball Hall of Fame, which I went numerous times when I was back in Connecticut, and the Football Hall of Fame, which I've been to several times already. Why isn't there more displays out? I don't understand. I really don't. And again, I really think it should be a priority for the leagues to expand everything, especially baseball and football, to get the to show the stuff to the public and to the historians who want to study it and so on and so forth. I don't know. I know I'm very old school, but that's definitely something that should be looked at, to say the least. Well, that's a great pickup, Jeff. And again, when you mentioned it before, it was totally macro. I can only imagine the history and those pieces that you picked up. Truly amazing. Now, that leads us again to Jim Thorpe and a bit about his travels in the 1950s when he went back to Carlisle. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, so I got contacted by somebody I'd done a deal with probably 5 years ago or so. Shows what, obviously, why you want to keep up your relationships in the hobby. He's a dealer, and he's up in the PA area, and he knows that I collect Thorpe stuff. So he knows if he sees anything related to Thorpe, you know, at least give me a call, and I'll tell him what it is, because a lot of times, you know, people that don't know this stuff like you and I do, they don't know what some of this stuff is, and they need advice, I feel like that's a easy way to, you know, ingratiate myself to people is to give them a little bit of information, right? So he contacted me. He said he had a set of photos. The back said they were from the early 50s. They had names written on them, and they had Thorpe in them. And he didn't know anything else about it other than he had this. He wanted to know what they were. And I looked at him. I was like, well, you know, it looks like to me, you know, they're photos from Thorpe coming back to Carlisle. I don't know why he came back, but I bet I can figure it out pretty quick. And he was like, oh, I don't care about that. Just tell me how much they're worth and if you want them. So I said, well, I do want them, number one. And, you know, here's what I kind of think they're probably worth. You know, I mean, that none of them had him in his football attire, obviously. He was 60-some years old or whatever at that point. So, you know, it wasn't, and they were from the 50s. They were type ones. I was pretty sure they were original from looking at them. But, you know, a lot of them weren't worth much, right? But, but actually one of them was signed by Thorpe. So I was like, that one? Now that one's worth something because the Thorpe, you know, Thorpe Auto is always worth something. And so we talked a little bit about it, and he ended up saying, you know what? I appreciate your help. I'll just, you know. If you give me this much for them, you can have them. So I picked them up. And then I started digging into it. What I found out was, you know, in 1950, you know, Thorpe was named the greatest Pennsylvania athlete in history. That was one of his designations. He was named the best football player in the first half of the 20th century. You know, that was a, you know, a voting contest that he won. And then, of course, he was named the greatest athlete in general in the first half of the 20th century. And all those things happened, you know, in early 1950 when everybody was reflecting about the, you know, first 50 years, the half century, if you will, the 20th century. And as part of that, he was invited to go to Harrisburg, PA, the capital, for a banquet they were going to have to give him this award as PA's greatest athlete. And the people in Carlisle got wind that he was going to be in Pennsylvania. And there was this company in Carlisle called Carlisle Tire and Rubber who wanted to get Thorpe to visit, and they wanted to get Thorpe, you know, to come and visit their facility and meet their people and do a bunch of, you know, some testimonial types of things. And so they invited him to come. I do believe he was paid. Which doesn't surprise me, right? Thorpe was always, you know, very careful about making sure that, you know, he got a little bit if people were going to use him for promotional purposes. So he was probably paid to go, which, whatever. But when I dug into it, what I found out was these photos were all taken during this visit to Carlisle. It had him with executives of the Carlisle Tire and Rubber Company. It had him with members of the Rotary Club, where I found out he spoke at lunch. And it had all this information. And the key one was this signed photograph, though, of Thorpe, was made out to the person who I found out digging around was the vice president and general manager of Carlisle Tire and Rubber. So he clearly autographed it for this guy who had set this trip up for him. And now one of the things he pushed while there, you know, at this time was when they were planning to film the Jim Thorpe All-American movie that came out, you know, a few years later. And he was really selling Carlisle on the idea that they should convince Warner Brothers, who was producing the movie, that the premiere of that movie, when it came out, the premiere should be in Carlisle. It shouldn't be in New York. It shouldn't be in Hollywood.
Right.
right. It should be in Carlisle. And he organized and got Carlisle Tire and Rubber to organize a committee to solicit Warner Brothers to allow them to have the premiere, which in the end, a couple of years later, Carlisle and Oklahoma City shared the premiere is where they ended up. So
right.
Oklahoma wanted it
right.
as well, obviously, because Thorpe, grew up there and that was his home.
Mm-hmm.
So they were petitioning as well. And so Warner Brothers decided to have co-premieres the same night. And one of the other items in this stack of things that I got was the ticket to the dinner prior to the premiere. And what I found out later from talking to the person who I got all these from was all of this came out of the estate of that general manager of the Carlisle Tire and Rubber Company. So he had collected this stuff up when Thorpe came initially to visit, and then he still had his ticket when he went to the premiere dinner that happened right before the premiere a couple years later. And he kept all that in a manila folder. It still said Jim Thorpe written on it. And inside he had every picture with the people's names on the back. And he'd kept this for, 50-some years. He lived to be almost 100.
Yep.
It was Jonas Werner.
Oh,
he kept this stuff. And then when he passed away, he got passed down through the family. And then they ultimately sold it at auction. And that's where this dealer contacted me, got it from.
Wow.
So it was just kind of cool, right? I mean, later in life for Thorpe, but kind of interesting to read about, his journey back to Carlisle. And apparently he was very moved by everything that they hadn't forgotten him. He mentioned several times in his speeches that he was so appreciative that people in Carlisle still remembered him and that they thought fondly of him. And he was so happy to be back. And he hadn't been back since, they said, before the war. So I'm thinking 30s, right? Or early 40s. And so he was quite touched by all the attention he got and everything that transpired, and obviously came back. And he did not go to Oklahoma for the movie premiere. He spent some time that week in Oklahoma. They had a ceremony for him and whatnot, but then he flew to Carlisle and he attended the premiere in Carlisle. Pretty
cool. Incredible story. Incredible.
I knew nothing about. I'd never heard any of this, right? I knew he had been, selected as the greatest athlete of the first half of the 20th century, but I didn't know any of this. Until I started looking into it just to figure out what these photos were. And knew nothing of this story.
Amazing. Truly amazing. That's a great pickup and a great story. And again, more history preserved again, through the auction sale and the dealer having enough common sense to call somebody who collects that stuff and see, if they would have any interest in it than trying to, throw it on eBay and whatever happens type of thing. So that's great. That's great. Another good pickup, Jeff. You're to be congratulated. Well, we're winding down the show. We got about 10 more minutes, and the next segment, next area I'd like to touch base on, something that I think it's close to both of us and many advanced collectors, is the constant story, the constant question, where's the hobby today, and where are we going in this year in 22? Mercifully, some shows are opening up again. Things are looking better as far as shows setting up. I'm getting interested down here in setting up at a couple shows in Lower Virginia near the North Carolina line and in Raleigh, North Carolina, a few other places. So I'm getting the itch again to set up and to move some inventory, talk about the magazine, so on and so forth. What is, the million-dollar question, where are we going, what's going on, what's your opinion? Give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm bullish on football stuff. Whether it's cards, memorabilia, whatever it is, I'm bullish. And I think it's, from the earliest days up through the modern stuff, football is hot, right? And I said from the beginning when I got back in the hobby over a decade ago, that I really felt, you said this yourself, that football has always been undervalued. You know, you look at these cards, these Grange cards, right? And he has 3, 4, or 5 cards where the population of each of them is like 3 or 4, right? And the fact that those sell for a fraction of what the football or the baseball players who have those kinds of pops and those kinds of credentials, Hall of Famers, sell for just doesn't smell right to me. And I always felt like, you know, pro football was roughly 50 years behind pro baseball in terms of a real league starting and getting off the ground. And that to me, just in my simple mind, said, well, the hobby's probably 50 years behind too. So we should be looking at, like, what were baseball prices 50 years ago? And, you know, with the growth of popularity in football and, you know, this idea that when the baby boomers were gone, you know, this whole hobby was going to collapse is utterly ridiculous. You know, you see kids today doing the same thing that we were doing, right? They're going back to their childhood, even if it was the, you know, the junk wax era, right? Those people are back, and they're, like, collecting stuff from their childhood, even though it was a crazy time back then and a lot of people got burned. They're doing the same thing we're doing. And it's just, it's the collector gene, and football is getting hot. I think that, you know, this run-up that happened in COVID, you know, of course it settled back down a little bit. But what I noticed was, you know, vintage did not settle like modern did. Modern dropped, as you would expect it, because it's very speculative. Vintage isn't speculative. You know, vintage is here to stay. And I think every time those speculative periods come, vintage takes a bump, and a good bump, and vintage doesn't drop. Or if it drops, it's not anywhere near what the rest of it drops, as it should be, right? This is tried and true players who are part of history at this point. And so I'm bullish on football. I really think as football continues to be the dominant, you know, popular sport, particularly the NFL, and that people still are going back to what they collected as children, it's helpful.
Yep.
Now, I hope that the market for cards makes it affordable again for kids to collect, right? Because that's my only worry is if we continue down this path where there's nothing kids can afford, then that doesn't bode well for 30, 40 years from now, right? So I'm hoping some of that gets corrected. That's the only risk I see. Is that you know things aren't available to kids like they were, right?
Right. And again, I agree with 101% of what you're saying, and I also believe too, and I've said this numerous times. There's different eras of football, and to me, the golden age of football collecting cards and memorabilia is the 1946 to 1988 period, where you can break that down to 1946 to 1972, the last year of series cards collected, 1973, the one series only of tops. So you got 1973 to 1988, and then you can break it also to 1946 to 1972. And then you have a 33-year period, which kind of freaks me out now when it's 33 years now from the junk wax era of 1989. And believe me, today I really don't see many discounted wax boxes of anything past 1995 or 1996. So it's just, you know, really a situation where you have, you know, like you're saying, hopefully some kids are going to be collecting so the hobby can continue. So that when they have the disposable income in their 30s and 40s, they go back to their childhood and buy this stuff. Again, I'm still shocked going into a store down here, Big Lots, and I see their little display of cards, which is so minimal. It's literally comical. But the wax packs are between they're not wax packs, but they're the packs of football cards are either $6 or $12. And I'm like, holy mackerel.
Yeah.
I mean, this was, this is crazy. It's just utterly crazy. I haven't been at a real show lately, but I can only imagine what I'm seeing there. And I've heard people tell me, you know, the 90 and 91 Pro Set boxes, you couldn't give away at $5 a box. I'm going for $15, $20, $25. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Absolutely nuts.
Yep.
But again, I have said for years, I have said since the 1980s when I got more serious into collecting older material, that football is very undervalued. It's very overlooked. And there's so many other aspects of football memorabilia you can collect: publications, team photos, individual player team issued photos. The list is endless of what you can collect. And we're not even looking at helmets, uniforms, and footballs, game used footballs and stuff like that. So yeah, I agree with you 101%. You know, it's a strong market. Modern cards will take a hit. They are up and down all the time, whether you agree with it or not. Anybody investing in modern cards, buyer beware. I would not put out $100,000 for a Tom Brady rookie, no matter how good he is. but I would, if I had that save $100,000, I would have no problem buying $100,000 worth of pre-World War II items. I would have no problem buying pre-1972 items and back for both collection and investment purposes. So to me, you know, there's always going to be a vintage market. 1988, like you, is my cutoff date also, even though I do have a lot of stuff from 89 up, but not to the point where I collected every set. You know, I don't have 60 different 1990, 91, 92 football sets type of situation. So it's, it's common sense. And again, when Cap stepped producing in 2015, that's the last complete multi-team football card set I have in my collection. After that, I just have the Packers police set, which I find out that they eliminated in, I think it was 2020 was the last they did it. So that ended that. So it is what it is. You know, I bought the packs down here when we moved to kill some time. I pulled up the Packer players, and that's basically all I'm saving. And it just didn't do a lot for me, believe me, compared to many years ago, even in the junk wax era, opening up a lot of junk wax from 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, when I was working in the card shop at the time, so on and so forth. It was a much different game, to say the least. Well, we're down about 2 minutes. Again, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website for subscription information, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Jeff, it's been a great pleasure to have you on yet again on the show. I truly appreciate your insight. I appreciate the things you've done for our hobby in a very short period of time, giving the hobby a great deal of credibility, a great pedigree as far as the historical analysis of many different time frames, teams, pieces of memorabilia, cards over the years. You are to be commended for your efforts, because they are Herculean, to say the least. Your final thoughts in 60 seconds.
Yeah, so one thing that's common about everything we talked about today is I got all these things through private deals. If people out there are interested in going after rare things, scarce things, et cetera, I cannot emphasize enough the importance of being in the community, sharing what you're collecting, what are you telling people what you're looking for, just engaging with the hobby. There's so many collectors that don't do that. And I can tell you, if you engage, if you share, if you write, if you talk, if you network, you talk to people, you're going to have stuff show up at your door. And that's the way you find this stuff, right? It's not showing up at auction a lot of times. It's private deals. And so I encourage everybody listening, get engaged in the hobby. Get involved with the hobby. Join things like VFC, Vintage Football Community, Bob and I are involved in, that talk about these things every day. And you'll be surprised when it comes back to you if you do that.
I agree 100%. Jeff, thank you for being on. We're almost out of time. We'll be back hopefully next week with another show. Until that time, thanks for listening. And again, check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com.
Thanks, Bob.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.